When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition comic book podcast where we discuss the famous, infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, Brian Reese.
Hey, Paul.
How are you?
How are we doing today?
I think both of us are severely ill.
We are, yes.
Yes, but we are going to plow through.
Please pardon our sniffling and snuffling and coughing and...
and just various unpleasant noises. Well, more unpleasant noises than what we normally produce.
That's what editing is for.
Yes. Well, today on the program, a classic story by a legendary creator. We'll be talking about DC, The New Frontier by Darwin Cook, which I'm very excited to talk about.
Yes.
But before we do that, there is something that was announced this week that has caused some feelings to be expressed by my cohort here.
Feelings.
And that announcement is Marvel 1000. This will be a one-shot coming in August to celebrate the publisher's 80-year history, which kicked off with 1939's Marvel Comics number one. Now, the numbering is a bit off.
Oh, I'm sorry, did you say Marvel's numbering is a bit off?
Yes, it's being described as symbolic. See, this would have been the 1000th issue of the comic had it continued all these years without interruption, which of course it actually didn't. But hey, don't let reality get in the way of a good marketing device.
Right.
Yes.
Particularly when the distinguished competition has had success with two number 1000s just prior to this.
Yeah, I mean, they are trying to capitalize on Action and Detective 1000, and they're trying to get...
Didn't Marvel used to call themselves the House of Ideas?
They had a good idea. Let's steal from DC. Yes, it's a gimmick. It's a gimmick. But the actual thing itself looks pretty interesting. So, all right, I've been talking too much. Why, you were the one who brought this up before we started recording, and you didn't like it.
Well, it's not so much. I think it's cheap. Again, and it goes back to, you know, the House of Ideas joke that I just made. It's like it's really not an idea. It's symbolic of like what Marvel has kind of become recently, and it's just a lot of recycling plots, recycling artists and writers, recycling, you know, other people's ideas. You know, Marvel spends a lot of time crapping all over DC, but yet is more than happy to steal. The good news on this is, so one speculation was that they were going to stop at 52 creative teams.
Really? And I didn't hear that.
Yeah, so, but they didn't. Luckily, it went beyond. So we found out that Marvel, even though Marvel can be petty, they're not that petty.
But the list of creators is astounding.
Sure. I mean, it's Al Ewing and like two other creators, I think.
No, have you not seen the list of creators?
I'm looking at the list. I have the list in front of me right now. And of the first 14 listed, 13 are Al Ewing. No, I know. It's like, I was trying to figure out what is it with all the Al Ewing? And then you get, of course, everybody else. You have Kieran Gillen, you get Walt Simonson, Tom DeFalco,
Jerry
Roy
Conway.
Thomas, Peter David, Mark Waid. So, you know, they're
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is going to be writing something.
Sure.
I mean, that's a slam dunk right there.
Oh, boy.
I mean, it's a tall order for him to write something.
So I get it. It's old home.
I got more if you like it.
Hold on to those and okay. Those later. I'm sure it'll be, but you know, it also came with the, so they're going to sell a million copies of this.
Ah, that's just marketing crap.
Right. Yeah. They're not going to sell a million copies of this. No, no. You know what they will do? They'll ship a million copies of this. You know about what Marvel does with the overships, right? They overship to, comic book stores, and those overshipments for free, but those overshipments count as like copies sold via Diamond, you know, so it's Marvel's way of that's how they inflate their diamond sales, which is what counts, and like, you know, sort of where they look at the other people could explain that whole business practice easier than I, better than I can.
I don't, but, I'm not, I can't speak to that because I don't know much about it.
So it's a thing. It's a thing that they do, which is why oftentimes their number share is higher than their dollar share, particularly when actual real comic book stores report on what is actually selling in their stores, as opposed to what Diamond is selling or overshipping. So it would not surprise me if Marvel ships, overships enough copies to say, look, we shipped a million copies of this comic to from Diamond to all of the comic book stores. And see, we sold a million, which technically is sold, but isn't really sold when you can buy it in a year from now for 25 cents in, you know, the quarter bins. But, you know, but that's like, it's that typical, like, you know, instead of, you know, allowing for the comic book business to have nice things and for other people to have successes, you know, it's like Marvel simply can't allow another publisher, not just DC, but whoever, they can't allow another publisher to have a success without trying to, like, then horn in and, oh, you know, outdo it. It's like, you know, we all know that that person who, whatever story you tell, they have a better story. Or, you know, you broke your toe. Oh, but I broke my foot. You know, and that's kind of what this smacks of. And I appreciate the breadth of creators that are doing these one-page stories. Yeah. But if I want to read, you know, if I want to see art by Mike Allred or read a comic by Jonathan Hickman, I would rather read a full comic by Mike Allred or Jonathan Hickman or whoever else, not a one-page promotional piece.
All right, fair enough. I mean, but I mean, everything you just said, they're a business. They are trying to make money. I mean, yes. I don't fault them for that. And you know what? Yes, it's a gimmick. It's a total gimmick, but I think it's an interesting gimmick. And if it's good, it's good.
But maybe write good comics.
They do have good comics.
Instead of doing gimmicks.
They do have some good comics coming out right now. So I will, I'm not going to get into that argument, but
right.
Yes. Marvel does.
But at the end of the day, don't rely on a gimmick, rely on putting out good product.
Yeah.
Like consistently and across the board.
Yeah. Marvel has always been, you know, the overhype, pitch heavy, overselling themselves, basically. Right. But there's a problem.
It was charming when Stan Lee did it.
Exactly. When Stan Lee did it, he was trying to build something new and you know, and push this new product. Nowadays, it comes off as cynical. And I get that.
You know, and a lot of that comes down to Joe Quesada, who was, you know, kind of a garbage individual. And
he's writing for this, by the way.
Yes, of course.
but, you know, yeah, I mean, if it's good, I can forgive a lot. We'll see. Doesn't come out till August.
And to be honest, I'm not really, as much as it sounds like I am, I'm not really butthurt about it. It doesn't hurt. It doesn't affect my life in any way, negatively or positively. But we're talking comics, and so when I see this, I'm just like, "Oh, really?" And I think that's more where I'm at on this. Instead of, again, I will still get up in the morning and live my life.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing.
But at the same time, it's just like, come on.
The funny thing is, when this was first announced, I'm such a Twitter guy now. I saw #1000. Why is that trending? It's number 1000.
Ah, yes.
We'll see how it
all. Since I don't do a lot of that twitting.
No, you don't. You should twit more.
I'll get right on it.
All right. So, you know, we'll see what happens in August. It might be a cynical cash grab. It might be an artistic achievement.
It could be the most awesome thing that has ever existed on the face of the planet in comics.
Yeah. But much like Action Comics 1000 and Detective Comics 1000, it's going to come and go and people will say, that was interesting. And then we move on.
That happened.
Yep. And that's what I think is going to happen.
Right.
So, should we take a break, plug someone we like, and then come back with some really good comic?
I think that sounds lovely.
All right. Let's do that.
Hey, Jared, I have a question.
What's up?
Well, I've been a part of the Longbox Crusade for about a year and a half now.
Yeah? No, that's not a question, man.
I know, I'm getting to it. That was called Build Up. Like I was saying, I've been with the Longbox Crusade and I have gone out and represented the show faithfully.
That's still not a question.
I'm still building up. I was wondering, could I be a part of the official promo? There's this great promo for the podcast that airs across podcast land and it has Pat Sampson, the founder of the show, you, the art cell artist, and your brother Jason, aka Weasel Skull, but it doesn't have me, Delvin Williams. items, the dark web. Could you ask the guys if they would let me be a part of the promotion since you were the one who invited me onto the show?
Well, not to be a Mr. Quick to correct, but that was at least two questions. Still, I guess I'll ask. Let me go talk to the guys and you stay here.
Okay, great. Thanks, man.
Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up, Jared?
What's up, Jared?
I have a question. Delvin's been with us for like a year and a half.
That's not a question.
Yeah, I know. It's called build-up. Hey, can we finally include him on the promo? It's the least we can do. He doesn't know that we're getting paid yet.
And he never will. I mean, do we need him? After all, we already have the Longbox Crusade.
And I provide awesome synopsis and insight on Crusader Chronicles.
And I host Saturday Matinee Theater and also provide these nuts jokes.
Hey, I do that.
Me too. So we're fine as it is. What does Delvin do? We should just let him go.
Wait, he hosts Transformers Chronicles. You should know that, Pat. You're on that show. So what do you say? Can we keep him?
Fine, let's do it. Let's do it live! We could have done this with him in the room. It would have made more sense. Why is he outside?
I think we were doing a bit. Okay, let's do this.
The Longbox Crusade Podcast Network is the place to be if you like deep dives into comics of yesteryear with the Longbox Crusade. Chronological reading journals with Crusader Chronicles. Indexing forgotten TV shows, films, and serials with Saturday Matinee Theater. Pitting two randomly selected action films against one another in Action Film Face Off, cataloging the Marvel run of the Transformers comic with Transformers Chronicles, and whatever else the demented minds of Pat, Jared, Jason, and Delvin can come up with. If that sounds like it might be for you, be sure to subscribe to The Longbox Crusade on iTunes, Google Play, and pretty much all reputable podcast feeds. Or check us out directly at www.longboxcrusade.com, where we continue our quest to...
And we're back! Brian, this week is your recommendation, so please let us know what it's all about.
And now for your pre-prepared presentation. DC's New Frontier was an Eisner Award-winning six-issue limited series written and drawn by Darwin Cook with exquisite coloring by Dave Stewart. Published in 2004, the series has taken its place amongst the pantheon of such evergreen titles as The Watchmen, Golden Age, Dark Knight Returns, Sandman, and Astro City. Spanning the years 1945 to 1960, and taking its name from the famous JFK speech, New Frontier is a love letter to not just the golden and silver ages of DC and superheroes in general, but to a time that, on its surface, was full of hope and wonder, but was also an era of fear and darkness, paranoia, and xenophobia. Cook makes a tableau of this age, never shying away from the undercurrent of the times, while creating a pop glow adventure on a grand scale. Ostensibly a story centered around the passing of the torch from the older Golden Age heroes to the upstart new faces of the Silver Age, Cook weaves the origins of Green Lantern, The Flash, Martian Manhunter, The Atom, Green Arrow, and others into a widescreen, high-concept, and high-octane sci-fi and espionage opus. Here be monsters of all types. Cook's art is masterful. Each line and panel are both a tribute to his predecessors and a mastercraft all his own, melding mid-century modern design, or space-age bachelor pad if you prefer, with dynamic action sequences and intricate small personal moments. With a veritable who's who of the DC Universe making appearances both large and small, New Frontier nods with great love to nostalgia, but like the speech that gave the book its name, does not fear to look forward to imagine the future in all of its bright, unexplored glory. Here there be heroes.
That was well done. Very good.
Oh, well, thank you.
I enjoyed that.
So obviously I didn't go into a lot of plot and I left, you know, this is very much an overview because there's no way to distill this into a pithy or even non-pithy summation.
No, absolutely not.
So obviously I recommended this. I have thoughts and feelings. Paul, I imagine you have thoughts and feelings too. I think you were excited about this. Doing this, was your excitement, did your excitement hold as you were rereading this?
Absolutely. This is just wonderful. Not to spoil what we're going to talk about, but yeah, this is great. I often blather on and on about how unique the medium of comics is, but if you need a prime example of why it's so great, look no further than this comic. It's a combination of art, illustration, prose, pulp fiction, cinema, and it's all combined in a way to produce something that no other medium can produce. This is It combines everything that is great about comics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I know that they made a film of it, which I haven't watched in low these many years, but it was basically just an animated film.
Yeah. I have not seen it, so I...
And so I can't really, my memory of it is dim, and so I can't really speak to how that translates into film. Of course, obviously, because it's an animated film, there's more leeway to play with it. You know, of course, they used Cook's artwork or art ideas in it as well. But I think one of the most striking things to me was the ability that you can't always do in, or do well in film is the mashing of genres.
Right, yeah.
And all of these genres that he's using are directly tied to what was happening. And so this is, you know, it's briefly in 1945. The vast majority of this takes place in the mid to late 50s.
Right.
So you had sort of ideas of the time and what people were interested in at the time were this concept of, you know, sci-fi was all the rage.
Right. Everything is chrome and curved edges and shiny and new.
And sci-fi films, everybody was fascinated by the unknown, by, you know, the outer space. We were entering the space age. Slowly, and, you know, Russia beat us to it, which is addressed amongst many other things. But there was the Red Scare was beginning. The Cold War was beginning.
The fear of atomic energy that was hanging, like this specter that was hanging over everyone's head.
This was reflected in, and of course, the pulp novels, like you mentioned, you know, where you also had the detective novels were all over the place, and you had this sort of, it was a really weird time. Like, I didn't live in it, so let me...
No, neither did I.
Neither of us.
Believe it or not, yeah, we're not that old, guys.
We look back at, and I'm going to say the 50s mainly, even though this starts in the 40s, 45.
The bulk of the story takes place in the 50s.
Artistic creativity that was going on at that time that was reflecting, this happens in every generation and every decade and what have you, but we tend to fetishize the 50s in many ways as a golden age, again, referencing a different James Robinson comic as well, which Darwin Cook said he definitely was influenced by. But you know, we look back at the 50s as this time of tranquility and peaceful and prosperity. More people were making money than ever before. We had become so technologically advanced, and you know, TV started becoming a thing, and film had started to improve, and the newsstand was full of like these shiny novels and lurid covers, and it just you know, and aliens were, we were suddenly thinking about aliens. And we were worried about aliens, and were the aliens from outer space, or were they the aliens from another country? That's something else entirely. But, you know, there's this very strong sense that we look back on this age, and I think Cook really plays on that. Really, I know I mentioned that in my intro, but I think it's worth repeating.
No, absolutely. I mean, the art, the story, the different genres, the multiple ways in which information is conveyed to you in the story, all with a sprinkling of nostalgia thrown on top. That's really an amazing way that he tells the story in an amazing way, I should put it. And the thing about it is he weaves real history in with the comic book history. So you still have McCarthy era Senate hearings, and you still have the Red Scare, and Korea. Korea plays a big part in this.
And Indochina.
And Indochina.
The rumblings in Indochina.
And racism and Jim Crow,
right,
plays a big part in this too. So he's not shying away from the, because, you know, like you said, the 50s has this gloss over top of it that, you know, everything was so nice and wholesome back then. But there was some really repressive crap going on at the time. It was not a good time
for a lot of people. It was a good time for some folks, but not a good time for a lot of other people. Yeah, and, you know, I mean, the story, like, we have appearances by, you know, Tricky Dick Nixon and Eisenhower is in this.
Well, Eisenhower was president, and Nixon was the vice president at the time. Right.
But they appear as characters. Yeah. Edward R. Murrow gets a bit.
Which is nice to see.
Yes, it's always good to see Edward R. Murrow, even in comic book form. Chuck Yeager makes a brief appearance. so many, you know, so, you know, Cook weaves these folks in throughout the story, and it really grounds it in many ways, where you have the fantastical of superheroes and, spoiler alert, in a living island.
Yeah, I didn't see that coming when I first read this.
So you're mixing in like sort of the very real and the very fantastical into one story, and it's so seamless.
Yeah, it's amazing. He obviously has a very deep love and nostalgia for this period, but he's also not shying away from the darker aspects of it, which, right. You know, it's a fine line to walk, but he does it extremely well. You know, when I first read the way the story is constructed, it's separate story. Seemingly separate storylines that seem all disconnected to one another.
The structure, absolutely, the structure is of how he composes this is,
yeah, and massive. It's linear, but they're all different stories, and then slowly they come together to tell this grand overarching story. Everything is connected, and everything does pay off in the end.
The reference in chapter 2 to a thing then becomes a bigger thing in chapter 5.
Right. Well, just the fact that in the very first story in this is a soldiers on a dinosaur island.
Right. The losers. The losers, amongst many of the people I didn't even name who show up in this, the losers.
And yeah, so they're on a, you know, soldiers on a dinosaur island. You know, that seems like a very self-contained story. But it turns out they're actually on the island that is the living island, which is the big bad of the entire story. So it all comes together, first and last chapters. You know, when I first read this years ago, I thought that's what this was going to be. I thought it was going to be little vignettes telling individual one-off stories, showing Darwin Cook's love of the era. But as it progressed,
in some ways they are.
Yeah,
you know, they are basically they are like a large amount of little stories.
Yeah, but all those stories mean something, and all those stories tie into the grander tale. Yeah, they're not. There's nothing just throwaway here. Everything means something. So like I said, like when I first read this, and it started, and as the story progressed, and it started to come together, I remember thinking, like, God damn, this is some great storytelling.
And to the point where I hadn't read this in years, and so part of the reason I recommended it. So you know, the first time I read through it, I got done, and I was like, oh man, I have to go back and reread it like immediately, so that I can remember the hints from the beginning as they played out. Because I would see it, but then I would try to remember the context.
Exactly.
Which was it was fun. You know, it was fun going back there and wow.
Yeah, I'd love to come in this. I love the way things came together. And Darwin Cook's style in this, the way he presents, because there's a lot of information dumping he's throwing in there.
But right.
He does it in such a unique way where it's either newspaper clippings or someone's journal or something, you know, and it's all very compelling. You don't feel like, oh, I have to slog through this to get to the real story.
The great scene, like in Vegas. So there's a portion of this that takes place in Vegas, of course, because it's the 50s, where Ted Knight, Wildcat, is boxing a gentleman whose last name is Clay. No first names, please. He's boxing Cassius Clay.
Yeah, and, you know, he cheated.
He cheated. Sort of, but not. You know, he just boxed the way that he was going to box. But after that, everybody ends up in, I don't know if it was the Sands. I think it might have been the Sands. You know, one of the famous places. And everybody is there. Bruce Wayne is there. Selena Kyle is there. Dinah Lance is there. Oliver Queen is there. Ace Morgan is there, Hal Jordan is there, Lois Lane, Rick Flagg. It's just a who's who. Now, some of them are meeting each other for the first time. Some of them never interact. But it's this long sequence where you're learning everything in dialogue.
Exactly. It's people meeting at a party. Yeah, because it's a party atmosphere. So they're right. All sort of just chatting over cocktails about politics, about something else. But they're, you know, little bits of information that you need to know for later in the story. It's all being laid out for you right there. And then, of course, Captain Cold comes in to do something.
Because Iris West just happens to be there.
Yeah.
Right.
So Iris West happens to be there on the phone with Barry Allen.
who had just a few panels earlier become the Flash.
An interesting little tidbit that I did not know the first time I was reading it, only when I was researching for this. Everything is actually in real time. So
yes.
the year Barry Allen became the Flash is the year, was it 1957?
That Barry Allen became the Flash in the comics.
Yeah, exactly.
I read that too because I did not know that. I wish I was a better historian, and I think I wonder sometimes, like throughout all of this, there are certainly things that I have probably missed, because as much as I'd like to believe I know a lot about comics, I am certainly not a doctorate in comics, and you know, like the true comic historians would catch up, but there's stuff I'm sure I missed.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And that was one of them.
There are several times where I admit I went to Wikipedia to say, and who is that exactly? Oh yeah. Cause I know a lot about what I know, but I don't know everything. Yeah. What I know well, but there are gaps in my knowledge, and DC and early this era DC is definitely, I haven't read much of it. Although
you now have an opportunity to.
Absolutely. That's the brilliance of doing a podcast, is I can have an excuse to go and do all the things I wanted to do, or read all the things I wanted to read.
Why are you reading that? It's research.
Yeah. Yeah, so I can sit on the train and say, oh, yeah, no. I see, I do a podcast, and I'm reviewing this, you see.
I'm also a DJ.
That's right. So I guess we should talk about Darwin Cook.
Sure. I think that's kind of... We could get to the specifics of the story or not get to the specifics of the story as we wish. But I think, Darwin Cook died, 2 years ago?
Was it 2 years ago? I know it was recently, ago. Yeah.
It was 2 years ago-ish. And rather suddenly, suddenly to folks who didn't know that he had been having health problems. The loss of Darwin Cook to the comics industry is... It's devastating, and you saw at his death how devastating it was just to other creators and the love that poured out.
Yeah, no, I mean, I remember it being a complete surprise. I was shocked when I heard, because he was only in his 50s. But as far as his stamp on comics,
it's small but large.
Yeah,
the actual work he did is not it's not massive. It's decent sized, but he got into the industry late.
He did.
He had worked in animation for a while, but he had really not been in the industry like as long as, you know, you get some of these, you know, what did Jim Shooter when he was 14 or something, but I think he was in his 30s, maybe. That's correctable, I know. So somewhere around in there, like when he actually broke into comics like full time.
Yeah, it was definitely later in life that he did that, but the impact he had was palatable. His style is so, it's so unique. It's very old timey and golden age. It has that feel to it, but it's still very modern at the same time,
right.
Which is a hard thing to pull off. I mean, it's cartoonish, but it's expressive in ways that feel more realistic than a realistic style could convey.
And in his work, so he did Catwoman. Very briefly, he did The Spirit, which also, he seemed to pick the right project. So he wrote and drew The Spirit for a while, like the relaunch of The Spirit at DC. He did the part, he did three Parker novels, like he did comic renditions of three of the Richard Stark's Parker novels, best known to folks as Point Blank, the movie Point Blank with Lee Marvin. The film. Sorry, that's now I'm getting.
No. He focused on what he was really excellent at, which is that noir feel,
right?
And kind of that old timey nostalgia. But he still made all that stuff feel very new and of the time, while still having that smoky noir feel to it. Really interesting. I mean, I'm struggling to come up with with the right words to say about it, how it's old and new at the same time.
Yeah,
it's really,
which reflects his storytelling
exactly,
not just artistically, but the words and the narrative. I've loved his art since I first discovered it. I will always look at it with awe, and you see, I think I referenced before, you see his influences. he's not aping his influences. He's making his own thing out of the influences. And other artists do that as well, but Darwin Cook was something special.
Right. And
I mean, each of these issues, this is six issues, but they're like 64 pages each. You know, this was a deluxe sort of...
Yeah, it's a long story.
Cardstock. And so each issue was basically three issues, you know, like if it's 64, 22, 22, 22, it's about three regular size comic books. So if you assume that you've got, you know, that's 18 issues basically. And so like having New Frontier is like a wonderful, like 18 issue long Darwin Cook fest.
And the way, and the styles he's using in this particular story, I mean, there's homages to Fleischer cartoons and, you know, the 1940s original designs, Kirby, you know, with the square fingers and the block right. chins and stuff. But still, he's able to put his own spin, his own take on these characters and make them uniquely his own while still giving you that feel of the era.
Yeah.
Yeah, just really an amazing style. I mean, what a loss. But we got what we got, and it's just wonderful.
And we're allowed to enjoy what we got.
Yeah.
So to the story itself, you know, there are multiple themes going on. And briefly, generically, the story is it's a bunch of origin stories that end up culminating into a sort of a monster of the week type situation. And I mean that as lovingly and as a compliment. So we've already mentioned that the big bad is a giant island that is living and is intent on eradicating humanity for very interesting reasons, and reasons that aren't necessarily
bad,
cut and dried black and white.
Exactly.
Again, another great aspect of this is many of the things that happen are not quite in that sort of, you know, good guy, bad guy element. But at the end of the day, the world must be saved. And of course, the Living Island needs energy to get off the planet. It's trying to leave the planet and it wants to eradicate the human race whilst doing so. Naturally and luckily for our purposes and for Darwin Cook's purposes, the island decides to go to the United States to find the energy and power it needs to.
Well, it is off the coast of Florida at the time.
Right.
So, and you know, there is an whole NASA thing going on at Cape Canaveral. So seems like a natural place to go. Plus we got all that atomic energy going on.
Right. It's the rocket fuel and all the various things that are right. So, but that said, and of course, so the heroes band together, the new and the old, the passing of the torch and, you know, work together to defeat the big bad.
But more than that, though, there's yes, that is. If you want to just look at the surface, that is pretty much it. But there's.
Well, I was trying to get that part of it out of the way so we could talk about the.
Yeah, and then I was just trying to segue into the other part.
All right. Yeah. Go and so way into the other part. Let's go.
Oh, but there's so many things going on because the it's not just Superman is Superman. He has some conflict going on because he's the big Boy Scout. Doing whatever the government tells him to do, and he believes it full force. But then he realizes over the course of the story that, you know what? Just adhering to the rules is not what makes someone good. It's one that you're made a hero by doing what's right, not regardless of what the law tells you to do. So that's really interesting as far as Superman is concerned.
Well, I think what's the Superman in this is also Darwin Cook, I believe, also cited Dark Knight as an influence as well. And I think that you see that with the Superman character, because the Superman early on in this is very much like the, like you said, the blue Boy Scout from the Dark Knight comics as well. And I think what is interesting is that Superman and Batman in particular are minor characters, and Wonder Woman is sort of in between. Yeah. She gets a little bit more to do, but Batman is featured not prominently, but a bit at the beginning, but by the end of it, he's got nothing to do.
Well, you actually, Batman.
He's got something to do as Bruce Wayne.
But I do like the fact that he, along with Martian Manhunter, actually does some detective work to try to figure
out detective work.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes.
Batman doing detective work.
And those are great scenes, like the Gotham, the detective work, the Batman, when he teams up with John Jones, the Martian Manhunter, and they do detective work together is kind of great. It's also a great scene, Slam Bradley being brought. I think Slam Bradley was one of Cook's favorite characters. Slam Bradley was in Detective Comics number one.
I know that because I had to look it up. That was one of the Wikipedia things I did.
He featured prominently in the Catwoman books that Darwin Cook worked on with Ed Brubaker. But Slam Bradley was actually he predated Batman, which is really interesting. Darwin Cook tried to work him into several different comics, and continue to use him. And I love the fact that Slam Bradley in this, Darwin Cook makes him look like Robert Mitchum. And then makes a joke, has Slam Bradley looking like Robert Mitchum, making a joke about how John Jones looks like a movie detective.
Right there. All right. So I said earlier that, you know, comics can do things that no other medium can. There is that one scene with Martian Manhunter trying to get to know what, you know, he's holed up in his apartment and he's trying to learn about the world through television.
Right.
And it's panel after panel of him shapeshifting into different characters that he's watching on TV, be it Bugs Bunny or Groucho Marx, and it's just perfect. It conveys all the information we need to know. We know who this character is, and it's so entertaining just to look at those panels.
They're such great panels, but it's also the humor is there, but it's telling the story, because there's also, you caught the fact that he's watching a commercial advertising a Soda Pop.
Yes,
and in the next panel, he's drinking that stuff that the commercial is advertising. And it's subtle. It's not, you know, it doesn't hit you in the face, you know, because you're paying more attention to the fact that he's Bugs Bunny in that panel.
Exactly. But he is drinking the soda that he was.
And then suddenly you look and you're like, wait, he's drinking soda. And you're like, oh, that last panel, he was watching an ad.
Yeah, it's really well done.
You get all of these little moments like that. There's another great scene. I know we're sounding like Chris Farley here, and we'll get back on it. But again, just it's more to reiterate what Darwin Cook does and how some of the humor that he inserts. There's a great scene, like in one of the last issue, where for a random set of reasons, Adam Strange and Ray Palmer are flying in to the coast to help save the day. And what you see is in the foreground, it's like King Faraday and maybe the Flash. I'm trying to remember who all they're talking, and they're talking about very important things. And in the background, just real subtly, because it's small, you see these two soldiers looking out the window as a very tiny Adam Strange and Ray Palmer are flying past the window.
Yep.
You blink and you miss it. I realize it's comics and you literally don't blink and miss it. But that's not the important part. You're paying attention to the important things that the characters in the foreground are saying. And meanwhile, there's just this scene of like two guys flying past the window.
Right. I know. His attention to detail is astounding. And it adds so much texture and so much depth to this story. But to go on, we're still talking about the characters. The idea of Martian Manhunter comparing himself to Superman, because he's an alien, but he's an alien-looking alien.
Right.
Who would scare people, whereas Superman's an alien, but he looks like a strong white guy, so people embrace him. And I love that idea of the... they're both noble, they're both good, but because of someone's appearance, we judge them differently.
Yes. And it's also the other. Like, and I actually have that... One of my theme notes was the concept of the other, which is very strong in this.
Oh, absolutely.
Whether it be, so the Martian Manhunter is an other. Superman is an other. Virtually all the heroes are the other, because
even Wonder Woman, she's from another race. I don't know, you know, they're Amazons, so.
And there's, you know, so the comic shows like how a lot of these people that become superheroes have this sense of being separate and being somehow not part of regular, normal, everyday life. And you compound that with the fact that the government in this and in real life is marginalizing regularly that which is the other, not just the superheroes, because in this, the the HUAC also kills, not literally kills, but shuts down the Justice Society. That's actually canon as well. But, you know, they're actively, there's some rough language in the Korea bits and in the Indochina bits,
yeah.
Referring to the Koreans and the Vietnamese and whatnot as being not like us.
Yeah. And Hal Jordan is actually ridiculed for feeling guilty for killing the enemy when he that, you know, which actually in reality that makes him more human and makes him more heroic.
Right. And the giant living island is another, but the giant living island views humans as the other.
As ants infesting the world.
Right. So, this goes on and on, and, you know, I'm not going to throw John Henry into this except to say that we'll talk about John Henry here in a minute, but,
But to get into Wonder Woman, she, you know, there's one part in Indochina where she's a badass revolutionary, basically, and tries to convey this to America, and she gets shoved aside because, you know, she's just a woman.
By Dick Nixon.
Yes. Nixon pushes her out of the way. There's so much being said in that little sequence.
Yes, there is.
Yeah. But she is seen as another for being a woman.
Right.
Even though she's, you know, still seen, she's given the Congressional Medal of Honor and good for you. Now get out of the way and go home.
But in the end, you know, there are at least two, you know, she is the one saving. It's what's interesting is like her story arc is she's always the one saving those who can't save themselves.
Right.
I don't know both in Indochina, where she saves the women, and then towards the end when she is, she saves Jimmy Olsen at one point, and she saves the Flash at another point. It's always her when someone is in dire straits. She is the one that is coming in and carrying them to safety. It has a lot of meta going on there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. She carries the franchise. But even today in the movies, she's still carrying the franchise. But, you know, I do like the fact that he also weaves in the fact, you know, there was congressional hearings on comic books back in the early 1950s.
Right.
Which caused the code and the ending of certain types of comics. And that kind of gets, you know, weaved in there. He sees that's a little subtle dig when they say that the Justice Society has to end.
Right.
You know, that's, you know, I appreciate that little, I don't know if it's subtle, but I you know, he knows his history. Darwin Cook does.
Yes. So what's interesting about like all of that, like we're talking about characters, we're talking about the other. And I think what is most intriguing, and we touched on this briefly, was again, it's, you know, Batman, Superman, and to a degree, Wonder Woman are not the prime players. You know, this is, at the end of the day, it's mostly Hal, we've barely mentioned Hal Jordan, Green Lantern.
I know. And
at the end of the day, this is kind of his story, maybe Martian Manhunter as well.
Yes, definitely. And you can kind of see Barry Allen sort of on the fringes as, you know, those three.
But certainly does not have the same panel time or extensive growth yet as these two. It is really, it's the green guys.
Yes, for sure. And, you know, this is a tribute to Darwin Cook's brilliance, is that he did make Hal Jordan seem cool. Well,
that's... Your least is he your least favorite character?
I'm not a big fan of Hal Jordan. I'm not a big fan of Hal Jordan. I just think he's sort of a boring, stiff, and not compelling. That's neither here nor there,
right?
But yes, but definitely Hal Jordan is a fully rounded, relatable character. I mean, starting with his experiences. Well, it starts with his experience as a kid meeting Chuck Yeager, which makes him want to be a pilot. He goes to Korea. He has that experience behind enemy lines.
Hal Jordan refuses to kill. He's a pilot with the Air Force, flying missions in North Korea, and he won't kill. He will use his flying skills. He's the best pilot in the world, or what have you. He will use his flying skills to move Korean planes into positions so that other people can shoot them down.
Which
is a little morally ambiguous.
Yeah, it's that whole Batman thing of I won't kill you, but I won't stop you from dying.
Right.
That's kind of the same thing, dude. Morally gray area there.
But, you know, eventually, of course, Hal Jordan does have to kill. And I'll let, if folks haven't read, I assume most people have read this. If they hadn't, haven't, then I'll let you find out why and how he kills.
Yeah, it's very tragic and sad.
Yeah. You know, you go from that and, you know, to his work in with Ferris Aircraft, his relationship with Rick Flagg.
Which is combative.
Which is and isn't because it's not all it seems, again, which you don't find out till later.
Yeah, it's very Harry Potter and Snape kind of a relationship.
That's a good reference.
Thank you.
And then you know, he gets the ring and you see the development there and his realization that he's not ready for certain things. And which is out of what you think is out of character for what we know as like the big, you know, the space cop, the man without fear. Well, he's not he's the man without fear.
he is a daredevil. I'll give you that.
He is a daredevil.
No, but you typically you see Hal Jordan as the arrogant guy who thinks he can just do anything, but he's much more humble in this. He's much more, he understands his limitations.
And much more careful about the decisions he makes, which is it's a really interesting development of his character, and that's why I think, you know, there's so many, you know, we meet we see the challengers of the unknown, which I love that team. We see the Blackhawks make an appearance. There's so many great characters that are introduced, and we see bits and pieces of their origin, maybe not the entirety of it. The Challengers of the Unknown get a really good origin story in this.
There's also Suicide Squad, which has a little subtle differences on it. They're actually heroes.
Yes.
You know.
King Faraday is made into a sympathetic character by the end. You know,
he seems like a real, he seems like the antagonist of the whole story.
And he kind of is, but kind of isn't. I mean, his arc in DC Comics has always been interesting to watch, and how, you know, he's always, you know, been on sort of the shadier side of things, not shady like good versus evil, but like, you know, he's always in the government sort of covert operations. So you're never always sure with King Faraday.
Which, by the way, as a lover of puns,
great names.
Yeah. What? As a lover of puns, King Faraday is just wonderful.
Yeah.
Always love that name. But I do, and it's, and again, it's Martian Manhunter. It's King Faraday meeting Martian Manhunter and coming to empathize with him and to understand who this creature who he's supposed to hate.
Right. It's the other coming in. The thing that Faraday fears most is the thing that saves Faraday.
Exactly. And that's,
or redeems him.
Yeah. That happens again and again and again throughout this story. I don't know when you want to talk about John Henry.
I think we have to talk. I mean, I didn't want to lump the John Henry story in with other more generic observation. You know, I didn't want to be like, oh, John Henry's just the other as along with blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Well, so it's one of the more obvious aspects of it. I mean, you have to talk about the civil rights movement and racism in the 1950s. That's a major thing that happened then. Well, I'll let you explain.
Well, I think so. Doran Cook was presented with a tricky wicket, as the kids say, not in the U.S. Make tricky wicket great again. So Doran Cook was presented with some difficulty, I think, in terms of the vast majority of the superheroes, not the vast majority, all of them.
All of them are white.
Are
white or can pass.
Right. Wonder Woman's not Caucasian. Well, that's another discussion for like a whole different comic probably. But yeah, they're all white.
Yeah.
Okay, they're all white. And
no, a black superhero in the 1950s wouldn't go over very well.
No. And so there was no source material really in the actual comics of that time that I think Darwin Cook had. There was no source material he could use. It didn't exist. So we do get in this, we get the story of John Henry, who was an African-American living in, is it Tennessee, I think?
It's Tennessee, yeah. He's attacked by Klan members, his church is burned, his family is killed.
Right.
And he becomes a masked vigilante and goes after Klansmen.
And he forges these giant sledgehammers. And throughout this, we get the song, you know, the myth of the John Henry, you know, the John Henry...
the old folk song.
The old folk song.
Yeah, or folk tale.
Is used as text throughout these things. It's done to really great effect.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought at first he was going to be Steel, but I know that's a more modern character.
Right. Well, but we get the, like, a young John Henry Irons sitting by John Henry's... John Irons sitting like a, you caught that, right? It's like,
yeah,
it's sitting next to, like, has Irons on his shirt. And so John Henry is eventually captured and killed.
Yeah.
Which leads to the Edward R. Murrow portion of it.
And but it ties, into the Martian Manhunter, because he's very, very obviously being the other and being of a different race. He feels very akin to the civil rights movement.
And it's the death of John Henry. Compounded with some other things, but the death of John Henry is certainly one of the reasons that John Jones, Martian Manhunter, decides that he is going to leave the Earth.
Right, or attempt it.
Yeah. Or attempt it, which, of course, then leads to him meeting King Faraday and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, we would go into plot weeds at this point. It's a very affecting bit, and I think...
It's very powerful, and it does motivate the characters in certain directions and cements people's attitudes.
Yeah. And shines a light on the fact that not everybody really cares. It's one of those things where Darwin Cook is showing, like, it's the bright and shining world that it is, but it's also, again, there's this darkness and these bad things happening. And
yeah, there's a lot of repression going on underneath it all. But in the end, the heroes all do come together for a last big stand. I did like that sort of Avengers Assemble type of ending. Well, that's kind of what it is. Or, you know, Justice League Assemble.
If you want right.
To that way.
Yeah, Justice League Assemble.
Sorry. Endgame is really in my mind right now. So I have Avengers on the brain. But yes, it is the Justice League coming together. I do like the fact that, you know, just on one page, oh, and Aquaman.
But that's also, like, that's really well done.
That's true. That is true.
It's really well done how he works up to that. You know, because we have, like, a panel or something of Aquaman earlier on, and he refers to the people on the Earth as the poisoners and the murderers.
Right.
And then we don't see him again, but during this massive battle, and it's a massive battle. This is like, when I say widescreen, it reminds me of, you know, it's just,
yeah,
you know, it's letterboxed. You could watch it and you should read it in letterbox. Don't read it in letterbox. That'd probably be hard to read. you get those little hints. There's like, hey, look, everybody, for some reason, there's a whole bunch of animals surrounding.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of sea creatures coming around the island, yeah.
Yeah, surrounding the island and somehow protecting the shore from all of the stuff washing, you know. And then there's the guy who gets rescued, and he's like, it was the strangest thing. These dolphins came and helped me out and rescued me. So you have all those nice little hints.
Yeah, Aquaman's there.
We don't know why Aquaman opted to side with humanity as opposed to let... you know, the floating evil island.
Well, I assume that the floating evil island wouldn't discriminate between Atlanteans and surface dwellers. It would just see everybody as, anyway, it's in his own best interest to help. I just thought that was kind of funny, because he isn't mentioned throughout the entire story, and then, oh, there, Aquaman's here too.
And then at the very end, boom, he's...
Yeah.
You know, again, it's not important that we understand. When I say that his motivation, we don't know it. It's not important that we know it in this story.
Right. Yeah.
That is a story for another time, and it was a story that was told throughout Aquaman's...
His own books, yeah.
Yeah, his own books and his own, you know, and Justice League and throughout the years and whatnot. So I think, you know... There are so many different things that we're glossing over. There are so many things that happen in this that we just simply can't talk about. We could talk about, like, Robin, the goofy scenes of Robin doing the weird acrobatic tricks while Batman is talking to Superman. We could talk about, you know, a children's book author named Theodore Smizel.
Yes. Writing a...
Yes.
Yeah.
Theodore Smizel, who wrote the story of the Living Island, which was a really fascinating reference. But, you know, find that out. And folks can read that stuff, find that out for themselves.
Yeah. Well, it's very... There's all these stories are so interconnected. And one, and as it progresses, you'd be doing it a disservice for us to just kind of say, and then this happened, and then this happened.
Right.
Because there's so many callbacks and there's so many interweaving of plot lines. And
there's an incredible scene on the moon.
Yes.
With Dr. Fate, the Spectre, the Phantom Stranger, Zatanna, and Shazam, or Captain Marvel.
Billy Batson, technically.
Billy Batson eating too much ice cream. And that scene actually is, that's kind of, there's where the theme rests, right? It's, I don't know if we want to get into that, but when I talk about like the passing of the torch and the idea of the Golden Age, mm-hmm. Slipping into the Silver Age, it is pretty much, it's solidified by this wonderful scene on the moon featuring these non-mortal beings.
It's fantasy and magic. Yeah, it's fantasy and magic kind of giving way to science and technology.
Yeah.
And saying, you know, that's theirs now. We need to step back. It is. It's a different genre allowing a new genre to emerge.
Right. But also several of those, you know, folks were part of the Justice Society as well.
Right.
So it's, you get a double whammy there. You know, I mean, it's, there's all these little things like that. And at the end of the day, I if folks haven't read or watched JFK's speech, and I believe this was the 1960 Democratic Convention, for his nomination. And this isn't politics. This isn't, you don't have to feel one way or the other about Kennedy on this, but the speech, which is, people refer to it as the New Frontier speech because that was going to be the tagline or his, you know, political campaign's sort of the running line that they're going to use. The New Frontier. It is such a powerful speech. So Darwin Cook uses portions of that speech in sort of the coda.
Brilliantly, actually.
Yes. You read it and it's, again, there's no... Don't worry about bringing your personal feelings about whatever we're all angry about today into this speech. It is not aimed at a particular party or a particular political viewpoint. It is aimed at looking forward to the future.
Yeah, throw your politics out the window and look at what the speech is actually saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what you, when you realize that, and as you're reading it, and as Cook uses portions of that speech as the framing device for the coda, which goes on a bit, you realize that the whole series has been that speech. That whole series has been working up to using, you know, every line in that has been a part of the comic coming up to it.
Yeah, at some point in time, yeah.
And so it goes back to one of our first things we said, which is structure. I don't know if he started, I feel like he must have, that speech was, he must have, right? Because
he actually says that. I have the, I'm reading the deluxe edition and it has some stuff by Darwin Cook at the end of it where he talks about how moved he was by that speech and how, I don't want to do him disservice by misremembering what he said, but what he said was, that was a point where America really didn't know what to do.
Right.
And Kennedy kind of came forward and said, this is what we need to do. This is how we look forward. This is how we move forward. And that's what inspired people to say, this is what we can do. This is what we can achieve. Keep moving forward. Keep finding that new frontier.
It's an incredibly poetic and incredibly hopeful portion of that speech.
Yes.
And again, Cook only uses parts of it. He doesn't use the parts that reference his rivals or anything like that.
It's the hopeful bit.
Right. But you read that and you're like, you look back at the comic itself and you're like, every portion of this, every panel that he's using parts of the speech with, because it's all like, that's the only dialogue is the speech, but you're getting these incredible images of basically what came after.
And how the heroes have moved on and incorporated, and just become part of the community and ask not what your comics can do for you. What you can do for your comics. But it's really, yes, it is. And it's a wonderful moving ending to this really fantastic story, and it's so hopeful.
Which is not, it's certainly not the grim and gritty.
No, not at all. And I
believe Cook has talked about that, the fact that, you know, comics can be good without being grim and gritty.
And he can actually reference something like The Dark Knight and still make it hopeful.
And hey, the Doomsday Clock, the Watchmen Clock is used as well. Is
it?
So he's referenced that, yes.
I did not notice that. Well,
it's not the with the blood, but there's a scene, you'll remember this, it's during the coda, where it's the one line, it's the one part where they don't show the heroes, and they just show the clock counting the big, it's the actual Doomsday Clock that really exists.
Okay, or, okay, you know, I get it. I didn't pick up on that. Excellent.
But that is most certainly a reference to Watchmen. We can't ask Darwin Cook, but I would place a large sum of money on that.
No, that makes perfect sense. This is just a well-constructed, well-told, well-drawn, hopeful, entertaining story. I can't say more than that. It's just great.
And it's bright and it's shiny and it pops. Like every panel just pops. And it's a joy to read. It's a, you don't even have to think about it. Like, we had to think about it because we were going to talk about it. you know what I mean? There are comics that I think about, and then there are comics that I don't think about. And you know, this can be read any way you want to read it. You can read it as like Rand, just overarching knock'em sock'em Dayglow superhero comic. Or you can read it as something deeper too. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, there's a lot of deeper meaning going on under the surface of this superhero comic. That's what makes this medium great.
Yeah,
it's just so good. Anyway, anyone who hasn't read DC's The New Frontier, do so. Why haven't you? If you're listening to this, you must be a comic book fan. Read it, and if you have read it, I mean, read it again because it's that good.
And fact checks are always welcome.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Do you have anything else you want to say about this?
No, yes.
Yes, of course. That's always our way. There's so much more that we could talk about.
There's whole characters and things that we haven't even touched. So, but yeah. No, I think for our purposes today, it's like.
So, do you have a question to ask me?
I have so many questions to ask you, Paul.
Well, when a man loves a woman very much. Oh, that's not the question.
So, Paul, apparently we do this on a bi-weekly basis.
Yes, we do. Well,
we do.
We try to.
Right. And in order to do that, we must have recommendations. And so because we need recommendations, and I recommended the last one, I believe it's your turn.
It is indeed my turn. So for my recommendation, I have chosen a Captain America story.
And this is a surprise to me, everybody.
Yes. So, you know, Endgame was released recently and, you know, no spoilers on that, but Captain America plays a big part in that and has a pretty interesting ending. So I was thinking of Captain America stories and I wanted to find one that was really poignant and really will capture the essence of who Captain America is. I've chosen for my recommendation Captain America issues 402 to 408. That story arc is called Man and Wolf. It's Cap Wolf.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
We're going to read, it's by Mark Gruenwald and Rick Levins as the...
I could get behind that.
So
you were trying to surprise me. I'm sitting here like I'm literally under my breath while you're doing this intro because Paul was actually waiting till this moment to tell me what the recommendation was. And I'm under my breath saying, not Secret Empire, not Secret Empire.
Nope. We're going to do Cap Wolf.
Cap Wolf. That's awesome. I can get behind Cap Wolf.
Yeah, so Captain America as a werewolf with I don't know if you've read this arc before, but it has it's in the 90s, so that's all that needs to be said really. And it's got
this was the 90s?
Yep, it's early 90s.
Wow. And, I don't think I was aware that Mark Gruenwald was still writing.
It's not long after this that Liefeld takes over, but He's still on it.
Well, that's a jarring.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But this particular arc has cameos by Dr. Druid and Cable and Wolverine.
Well, of course it has Wolverine. It's the 90s.
Yes. And it also has Wolfbane. Yeah. So it's a, yeah, this is not going to be a deep one. There's not a lot going on under the surface. It's just Captain America as a werewolf in the 90s.
Awesome.
All right. So again, that's the arc Man and Wolf, and it's issues 402 to 408. If you're planning to read it along at home.
Awesome. I'm giddy.
Good. I was hoping you didn't groan when I chose it.
It was a Secret Empire, so I'm good.
Okay. I would not do that to you nor myself. I guess that's it for this week's episode. Thank you all, as always, for listening. Please, we love your feedback. We love your comments. Send us an email at comments@collectiveeditionpodcast.com or leave comments on individual episodes at our website, collectiveeditionpodcast.com, or hit us up on Twitter, and by us, I mean me, at CollectedEDPod, CollectedEdPod. But again, thanks you everyone for listening. I appreciate you being here for us. That's a terrible thing to say. We need to come up with better ending. Gotta have better endings. Anyway, so goodbye, everybody. Keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at @CollectedEdPod. That's Collected, E-D-P-O-D. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're bringing everybody back. But seriously, did you see how much Al Ewing is writing? Al Ewing and Cafu, Al Ewing and Carlos Pacheco, Al Ewing and Chris Weston, Al Ewing and Christian Ward, Al Ewing and Corey Smith, Al Ewing and Daniel Acuna, Al Ewing and George Perez, Al Ewing and Jesus or Jesus Saez, Al Ewing and Joshua Cassara, and Al Ewing and Mike Diodota Jr., Al Ewing and Ron Garney, Al Ewing and Steve Epting.
He is writing the best-selling comic around today. So
the Hulk one?
Yeah. Immortal Hulk is...
Is it the best-selling, or is it the best-selling on eBay?
It's the best-selling. It just passed Batman this week.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But will it pass Doomsday Clock, if Doomsday Clock ever comes out?
Yeah. Shit.
Because there's that.
I saw that Doomsday Clock was being delayed, and I was like, thank God I dropped that ages ago, because that would have pissed me off.
It doesn't bother me, because I don't put them away or anything. I get them, I read them, I set them aside, and I'm like, I'll reread it all, you know, and I'll read each in issue individually, and then I'll reread it all as one big thing when they're all out. I don't worry about lateness in comics. And maybe that's because I get enough comics that, you know, my monthly stash or whatever, my weekly monthly stash is large enough to keep me entertained, that if a comic is delayed, I'd rather, like, I would rather a comic be done correctly with the full creative team rather than have it come out monthly with a bunch of fill-in artists like fiddling around in it. So for me, Doomsday Clock, it's if it's Gary Frank that needs the extra time, I love Gary Frank as an artist, so I'm more than happy to wait for Gary Frank to give the best art he can give to it.
Okay. Fair enough.
But I'm still going to make jokes about it being because every couple of days you see it's being delayed further and further. So it is funny.
Yeah. Well, it was supposed to end months ago.
Yeah. People get their underpants all in a bunch about, you know, late art, and I'm like, or late issues, and, you know, so-and-so used to do 5 comics a month back in the day. I was like, yeah, but their art was not as intricate as some of this, and that's not, by intricate, I don't mean like Kirby. It would be amazing to see what Kirby could do now with the technology at his hands and with the allowance for more expansion, like in background scenes and things like that. That wasn't how they made comics back then. So Kirby could still do his great style, right? But, you know, there's not a whole lot of stuff going on in the background in some of his panels.
Well, and that's in every panel, but good.
Right, and that's on purpose. That was to allow the comics. That has nothing, that's not a dig on Kirby or anybody else. It was a way to get the comics done quickly and on time because, you know, that stuff that you did come out monthly, it was a different business model. If you allowed Kirby all the time in the world to craft each panel, you know, first of all, it would probably take him a little longer than back when he, you know, than before. But can you imagine how amazing those would look? If Kirby could do one title a month or every 2 months and they were just like, fill in every space you want, go crazy. Oh my God. That would be the pinnacle of maybe comics greatness right there. Feel free to use, though. You could use all of this.
If nothing else, I think that's going as at the end.